You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
It started this morning. I'd also like to welcome all of you in the room and on the web to today's event on the annual State of Biomedical Innovation here at the Brookings Institution. I'm Mark McClellan. I'm the director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform here, and today's conference is part of a series of public events and other activities that we support on biomedical innovation. Our past topics in this area have included issues in improving the clinical development pathway and the regulatory review process, as well as new reimbursement models for innovative products. We're going to keep coming back to those issues, and you'll see we'll touch on them today as well, because this is a really critical topic, and we hope that today's discussion will help set the stage for ensuring that policies that are aimed at improving innovation are having the maximum impact possible. This is a critical topic because of the importance of biomedical innovation. Without a doubt, improvements resulting from biomedical knowledge have had a transformational effect on the lives of Americans and people around the world because of their impact on the treatment of virtually every health problem facing people around the world. But as we've seen more opportunities for innovation, we've also seen the costs of biomedical research increase. We haven't seen a proportional increase in the rate of biomedical progress, and many believe that more resources in early stages of development, while very important, may not be sufficient to address the problem. I'd like to say that that support for the inputs, more spending on biomedical research at the NIH, finding ways to get more support for biomedical research in the private sector are both really important. But research and development isn't just about the levels of funding. It's also about improving the certainty, the efficiency, and the predictability of the development process so that good ideas can be translated into safe, effective, and reliable products as quickly and efficiently as possible. So we get more bang for the buck for all of that spending. And in turn, that might lead to even greater support for further investments on both the public and private side. So if we really want to make progress in getting better products to patients more quickly, this is a critical topic. And if we really want to make progress on identifying which policies are working best, we need measures. We need metrics to know how we're doing throughout the entire development pathway, the preclinical phases, the clinical phases, regulatory review, and post-market use of medical products and post-market innovation in how products are used. So in this event, we want to go beyond looking at just the overall levels of public and private investment in research and development, important as those are, and look at some of these other factors that also have an impact on the efficiency and the productivity of the biomedical enterprise. Part of the reason for emphasizing metrics that we'll discuss later on in this session is to help us focus in on steps that can measurably help us improve the development process, the research and development process. So that brings me to the goals of today's events. What we want to focus on is to start a dialogue around the places in the development pathway where new policies affecting biomedical innovation can have the greatest impact, and we want to link that to a discussion of metrics to help answer the question, how do we know when we're really making progress in these areas? These are topics that obviously have been the subject of a lot of discussion, not only here in our work at Brookings, but in many other efforts in conjunction with the just passed FDA legislation, in conjunction with private sector initiatives, in conjunction with efforts by the NIH and others to promote more biomedical innovation. And so we're going to come to these, do a more detailed discussion of these steps during the course of the day, hopefully with leading to some identifiable next steps for how we can do more to understand not only which policies have the most promise, but how do we know whether they're actually having an impact. So we're going to do that through two main panels. Our first panel will include some of discussion of the collaborative steps that are being taken in both the public and private sectors to make this kind of progress, to validate disease models and markers, to enable faster and more efficient clinical trials, to create more efficient mechanisms for developing additional safety and effectiveness evidence once products are approved. This will include Francis Collins from the NIH, Commissioner Peggy Hamburg from the FDA. They will be talking about some of the ways in which NIH and FDA are supporting innovations in the process of research and development and in collaboration in many cases with the private sector. We'll also hear from Kevin Shearer, who led the PDUFA negotiations for the pharmaceutical industry. He'll be providing an industry perspective on the innovation ecosystem. And we'll also hear from Ron DePeno, who recently took over at MD Anderson. He'll be sharing his ideas and some of the steps that MD Anderson, as a leading academic center, is implementing on improving the research and development process. After we hear from that first panel, we're then going to turn to that further discussion of metrics that I described. So implementing policies accompanied by better knowledge of whether these policy reforms are effective. There are a lot of well-known metrics in this area, things like investment levels, the number of new products entering the market, but we want to augment those and discuss those in more detail as well. For example, one of the metrics discussed in some of the recent FDA reform legislation is the evaluating how often products have repeat review cycles at FDA because that may relate to the predictability of the FDA review process, and whether and how many therapeutic areas use surrogate markers, biomarkers that can be measured in the short term for valid, predictable information on whether or not a longer-term clinical benefit actually exists, thereby potentially reducing the time for clinical trials. The background document, which you all have, outlines four areas where it's important to assess performance and develop and improve potential metrics, and our speakers during the second panel represent some of the leading experts from the investment community, the medical device community, the academic communities on these topics. In their opening remarks, they'll talk about what metrics they think are most meaningful and how to collect the relevant data. So we're hopeful that one of the outcomes from this event will be a continued and strengthened partnership with the people who are involved in today's discussion, hopefully leading to more extensive, a validated dashboard for measures that could be updated regularly to support more efficient and systematic evaluation of policies and thereby generate more support for the policies that have the most impact on improving the biomedical R&D process. This event will be a success if people leave here today with a better understanding of what it's really going to take to improve the research and development process and to get treatments to patients more quickly and reliably. And also, if people leave here with a renewed interest in the importance of tracking how we're doing to generate more support and more effective support for these critical policy issues. In order to help us facilitate this discussion, you all were provided with a discussion guide this morning along with today's agenda and the biographies of the participants. We've also got printed handouts of a few slides that we're going to have presented during our second panel discussion. In the packet, there's a brief 8-question survey. That's the blue sheet. We want to have events that are both interesting and productive, and we really welcome your feedback regarding today's conference. So we'll hope you'll take a minute or two to complete this survey after the event. We'd really appreciate it. There's a place at the registration table where you can drop those off. Today's event's a public event, as press are present, and the event is being webcast live and recorded, so everything here today is on the record. And we hope to move the discussion along pretty quickly. For those of you who are on the panels, our timekeeper, Paul, up here in the front, is going to help remind you of where we are in the process. And throughout the morning, we'll have several opportunities for all of you who are here in the audience to ask questions and make brief comments. We do want this to be interactive, so when we get to that point, we will have microphones moving around the room and come to you to enable you to ask your questions so that people who are listening online can hear it as well. So that's the plan for the day, and I'd like to get started right away. I'm very pleased to have joining me for our first discussion this morning to kick off these topics is Senator Michael Bennett from the state of Colorado. Senator Bennett has been actively engaged in biomedical legislative issues since coming to Washington in 2010. This includes recently championing the breakthrough therapies designation for drug approvals as part of the Food and Drug Administration Safety and Innovation Act. This is the act that just passed the Senate yesterday and includes the $6 billion in funding over the next 5 years for to augment the FDA's resources available for review processes related to innovative medical products. Senator Bennett, in addition to being a leader on this issue and getting this bipartisan legislation through Congress, in some ways ahead of schedule, is a member of the Senate Committees on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, as well as the Special Committee on Aging. So please join me in welcoming Senator Michael Bennett up front. We're going to sit here in the middle.
Right here?
Right here is great.
And good morning, everybody.
Glad we've already got you microphoned up and can get started right away. It really is, for the short time that you've been in Congress, a pretty strong emphasis on biomedical innovation issues. What led to that being a focus of your work here in Washington?
Well, I appreciate your having me today. I was up late last night because of the fires in Colorado, which we're watching. And if anybody's planning on vacationing in Colorado this summer, please go. You should go. What led to me, it's interesting because when I meet people that are in this field, a lot of the time what I hear is, well, I had a relative who was sick or I, you know, had an experience of my own that was medical. My interest in this actually came from something else, which is a concern about some very significant structural issues that we face in our economy. When I start a town hall meeting in Colorado, I often show a slide that has four lines on it. The top line is our gross domestic product, our economic output, which today is higher than it was when we went into this terrible recession. And the second line is productivity, which has gone up and actually recently straight up, but it has gone almost straight up since the early 90s because of our response to competition from China and India and the use of technology. And then the recession itself, which drove that line straight up because firms were trying to figure out how to get through with fewer people. But the two other lines on that slide are ominous. One is median family income, which is continuing to fall and has fallen over the last 15 or 20 years. And another one that shows that there are 23 or 24 million people that are underemployed and unemployed in this economy, even though our output is what it was before we went into the recession. And I look at the bioscience industry and I say to myself, well, in Colorado we have 600 companies that are engaged in bioscience in one way or another, and they're paying an average salary of $74,000. And it's alarming to me that we're beginning to see venture capital go abroad to invest overseas because of the regulatory uncertainty here. So the question from my perspective was, what can we do to try to advance an ecosystem here that says we'd like to hold on to this industry, we'd like to hold on to this research, we'd like to hold on to these clinical trials and everything else that relates to this supply chain if we can. And I think that we've made some important strides forward working with the industry and the FDA to create an environment where hopefully the future is going to be very bright for bioscience in the United States.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. So with every piece of FDA legislation, there's a new acronym that comes along, it seems like. So now it's FDASIA.
I don't even know what that means.
Right, well, the Food and Drug Administration Safety and Innovation Act that that just passed, as you said, in the Senate yesterday. This one got done ahead of time, so you know, at least by FDA standards, not working up until the last minute. It passed the Senate with 96 votes in an era when people are saying that bipartisanship really isn't feasible, especially on healthcare issues. What made this different? What made it so? What made this process work relatively well?
You made
well?
It work yeah. better. No, and I want to thank everybody here that's been involved in the process. Which I really think should be. There was a headline, I think it was in Politico yesterday, maybe, and it said something like, this process is not a model for other committees. I totally, totally disagree with that. I think actually it should be a model for how the Congress ought to work. And not only did we get it done ahead of schedule, but in the land of flickering lights, a place where we have come to measure our success by whether we've extended something by 1 month or 2 months, or, you know, we kept the government running one more day. This is actually a full 5-year reauthorization of this legislation. And it's astonishing. And I think the reason it worked is that for almost 2 years, we had people working in a completely bipartisan way under the leadership of Chairman Harkin and Ranking Member Enzi, and we just kept at it. And I have to say also that I think both the FDA, and Peggy Hamburg deserves huge credit here, and the industry came together to get to resolve these issues in a really straightforward way. You know, there was a I kept hearing from device makers and some of our pharmaceutical companies about this trouble or that trouble. They come to Washington and meet with me, and then go to the FDA and lament various things. And I finally said, you know, maybe we could do this in a different way. And I asked Peggy if she'd come to Colorado and meet with our bioscience community. And she said yes. She didn't hesitate at all. She came to the University of Colorado and sat at a table with 70 people that represented the device manufacturers, the pharmaceutical people, academics, people interested in technology transfer, even outside of the bioscience field. And she listened to what they had to say. And I think that orientation was really important to getting this done, and it ought to be a model for how we ought to be working through these things throughout the Congress.
And in the legislation, there are a number of provisions where you paid some particular attention. I mentioned the breakthrough therapies provision earlier in my introduction. You're also involved in some of the important revisions that are coming in FDA's accelerated approval pathway. What do you, can you comment a little bit more on what provisions you were most focused
why? Yeah, for us it was sort of an interesting balance. I think actually the first discussions we started to have on this bill were about the supply chain, you know, and the fairly straightforward observation that in 1938 when the act was first passed, we produced our pharmaceuticals in the United States. And today, 81% of the active ingredients in our pharmaceuticals are produced abroad, and the FDA had no regulatory authority for how to think about that. Shocked a lot of people that I represent. And now the FDA will have a way to think about that and set priorities for inspections, and also the burden of proof at the border will shift so that the FDA can do a better job protecting us from counterfeit drugs. And there are things we didn't get done, like track and trace, which Richard Burr and I will continue to work on and want to continue to try to get done. Breakthrough therapies, the way I think about that is, you know, if the FDA is going to have the chance to apply 21st century science in through its regulations. And if an oncology drug, you know, works well in one set of patients, and we know that because we've learned a lot about the genome and we've learned a lot about these patients, but won't work well in other patients or produces side effects in others, we ought to be approving it for these patients that need and will respond to it. And Mark, you had a lot to do with that. But if we can, you know, in cancer and diabetes and Alzheimer's, I mean, I think there's enormous potential here because of the breakthrough therapy piece. On the medical device side, what we've said is that we'd like to go back we are going back to the standard that was there in 1997, the least burdensome rule that said, you know, we ought not be asking companies for paperwork that's not relevant to making the decision so that we can get this stuff approved or disapproved in a more expeditious way. That's going to give, I think, regulatory clarity to our manufacturers and to our investors. It's going to be very important to keeping the industry here.
So important legislation, and you highlighted some provisions that have the potential for a lot of impact on the issues that we're talking about today. But these are big challenges. I wanted to ask you about a couple of potential challenges ahead, even with the importance of the recently enacted legislation. One is the fiscal challenges facing the country. So with more pressures on spending, how do we balance the value of the investment in biomedical research and development with some of the other national priorities that are also facing strains in light of our deficit outlook and the related fiscal pressures?
a couple of thoughts on that. One is that unless we come to a comprehensive deal around our debt and our deficit, we're going to continue to see domestic discretionary spending get cut. And that's been the story of the last 2 years. And if it's the story of the next 2 years, I can tell you we are going to hollow out the investments that we make in basic science, in bioscience generally, at the NIH. I mean, so it is, in my view, long past time for us to come up with a comprehensive approach that comprehends, that math compels us to have a discussion about revenue and a discussion about reform of our entitlements. And people of goodwill are going to have to come together across the aisle and figure out how we take out $4 to $5 trillion over the next 10 years to change the trajectory of this debt. This will not be the hardest thing that anybody does in their life, and we ought to get on with it, in my opinion, because the rest of the world isn't waiting for us to get our act together. And some of the rest of the world's actually in a tougher position than we are in, Europe, for example. And I can't think of anything that would create more velocity for our economy and economic growth and therefore benefit diminish our deficit. I can't think of anything that would reassert America's leadership in the world than making some tough choices here around our fiscal health. But as we make those choices, it's very important for us to ask some questions about priorities. And my view is that we ought to be thinking about our tax code and our regulatory code and our legislation in much the way we approach this FDA reform, to go back to the beginning of the conversation, in the sense that we should be asking ourselves, with everything we do, is this more or less likely to drive job growth in this country? Is this more or less likely to drive wage growth in this country? Are we able, once again, to say that economic growth is coupled with job growth and wage growth in the United States? And I think if we ask those questions, what we will find is that we are producing the innovative economy that we need. I've come to see, for whatever it's worth, before they roll me out of here, in case I get hit by a bus on Massachusetts Avenue, somebody here might take up this mantle. I've come to see that the left-right conversation we're having in this town is pretty much a fraud, you know, and sort of a bunch of special interests masquerading as two political parties, rather than, and because if you listen hard, you're going to have to work at it to find content in the ideas that are being offered. And I think for those of us that care about these issues, the axis we should be thinking about is future versus past, not left versus right. And there are incumbents that understand that that's the axis that they're on, and they're understandably fighting very hard to keep the benefits that they acquired in the last century. But that may not be what we need to drive job growth and wage growth in the 21st century. So I want to say again, thank you, because I think that with this legislation, we actually have pointed the compass north again. And for a whole set of issues that I care about, this is going to become a touchstone for that other work.
Well, clearly, you've been spending a lot of time and effort on addressing these big challenges facing the country and with bipartisan support. That's going to continue to take a lot of your time and effort, hopefully with some progress in the months ahead. What do you see as next on the biomedical legislation side? So you've done the FDA reform legislation. That's going to have some impacts. What's next on your mind?
I guess that probably the two things that come to mind are the work that we tried to do and didn't finish on track and trace with Senator Burr, and we'll have to see whether there's some other vehicle for that. And then I think, frankly, that the conversation we have around comprehensive tax reform in the new year may have significant implications for what we're doing in bioscience, the way we think about manufacturing in that context, the way we think about the research tax credits. I mean, all of that stuff is going to be of interest to everybody here. You may not think that now, but you will believe it next year. And I encourage all of you to be involved in that conversation. Again, saying to people, you know, is this really aligned to what we want to see in the 21st century in the United States, or are we having an argument that we had 50 or 60 years ago that really isn't relevant to where we're headed?
Lots to think about going forward. We have a few minutes with Senator Bennett left. I'd like to open that up to questions from you all who are here with us today. If you have a question or comment, could you raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. One up here in the front from Ellen.
So Senator Bennett, Ellen Siegel, so we are extremely happy about Breakthrough and happy about your work. One of the challenges with FDA is this issue of innovation, risk-benefit, this issue of safety, and Congress seems to be very divided on it. How do you really educate members on benefit risk and innovation and what that all means?
Well, Ellen, first of all, thank you for all of your efforts around this legislation. It was really important, and I think you have been a voice that I think has challenged people to think about whether that's even the right way to frame the balance. And I saw an evolution in the discussion and the debate around this bill and a recognition that innovation isn't at war with patients' health and that they are actually aligned. The FDA has a job to do to make sure that the devices that we use and the drugs that we use are safe. That's their most important the most important thing that they do. But we also should be regulating in a way that gets the most innovative therapies to our patients. And I think breakthrough therapy is a good illustration of a recalibration of the balance, a new way of thinking about this. Because if you're a patient and you're in need of a drug that will work in you and may not work in somebody else, the fact that it doesn't work in somebody else is not of a lot of interest to you. The fact that it will work in you is of great interest to you. And the ability for the FDA to recognize that and acknowledge that through its regulations, I think, is a very important step forward.
So building in a more targeted approach.
Yeah, and I do think that obviously that's where the science is headed as well.
Another question right behind.
Morning, Senator. Dan Perry with the Alliance for Aging Research and the ACT-AD Coalition, Regulatory Science for Alzheimer's Disease. Thank you for your leadership on biomedical innovation issues. With budget sequestration looming in January, there is a lot of scrambling to try to save various priorities from the automatic budget cuts. A lot's being done around defense. Do you see any possibility that with appropriate coalescing between not-for-profit groups and industry and science, there could be some chance that NIH or some of the key scientific priorities could be spared if the worst happens?
Whenever anybody asks me if I see any possibility, I always say yes. Any possibility. We would be crazy, in my view, to allow the expiration of the Bush tax cuts through our fecklessness at the end of the year. We would be crazy to allow the sequestration to happen through our own fecklessness by the end of the year. And I hope we don't do that. I hope that we come to a bipartisan agreement that allows us to avoid all of that. But there's a reason that it's been designed to be as ugly as it is, and that's to force actors that would otherwise not want to do the work to do the work. And I think it would be hard to change the sequestration unless we have evidence that we are actually on a path to resolving the fiscal situation that we're in. So the time for rhetoric is over. The time for hiding our heads in the sand is over. And it's now time to do the work. And I will tell you that there have been, some of us have been working on this I've been here since 2008, been working on it since then. But this summer, there have been weekly gatherings of people in the Senate, Republicans and Democrats. Last week, we had 35, I think, Democrats or Republicans. The week before that, 40 Democrats and Republicans, really talking about how do we create a set of conditions where we can actually get something done. Rather than try to score political points at a time when we can't afford to do that anymore. And I think that's a welcome change in the conversation that we're having. And again, you asked what could nonprofits and others do. I really do believe that. Let me say it this way. If I could go home and say to people in town hall meetings in all over the state, we're a third Democratic, a third Republican, and a third independent in Colorado. If you could say to people, we materially address the problem, we're all in it together, and it's bipartisan, that's all I would need to say. That's much more important than the, you know, specific details. They want to know that we're moving forward with a commitment to get this done, which, by the way, is what the capital markets want us to do as well. Those generalities, again, are more important than the details. I don't mean the details aren't important. I just mean it's a relative matter that that outcome is most important. In this town, people want to fight over every single one of those things. And while at home, it's very easy for people to understand that if you could put a plan in front of them that kept Medicare essentially the same for people that were on Medicare or, you know, anywhere close to being on Medicare, but changed the program for people that were my age so that it was preserved for us when we got to that age, that seems like common sense to them. In this town, it seems like it's a binary situation where you're either leaving it exactly the way it is for all time for everybody, or you're throwing out this important entitlement program. Same on the revenue side. Exactly the same kind of situation on the revenue side, where people here say, well, if you, you know, raise one tax or close one loophole, that somehow you're breaking a pledge about raising taxes. Whereas at home, what people want to know, again, is that we're all in it together. And I think that the nonprofit community could play an enormously important role in trying to get us out of that line drawing and into a place where we're actually coming to a consensus, a principled consensus, about how to move the place forward. But to do that, one has to not accept the lines of, you know, argument that the groups in this town are insisting upon.
Taking a broader step to support the kind of bipartisan process.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And to say, you know, there's virtue in people working together across party lines. There's virtue in getting this addressed and getting it done and getting it behind us. And we don't have to struggle, you know, for the very last program or for the very last cent on the revenue side. We have to get past that mindset. These are not lines that people in the country, at least in my state, are drawing. They are lines that are drawn in Washington. And I understand that to some extent. You know, if you've been hired and you're working in a place whose purpose has been to defend this one thing, and your job while you're there is to defend that one thing. And if you have 100, you know, or 1,000 organizations that are designed to do that, you can sort of see what the ripple effect of that is. And what we need to be is in a posture now of how you get to a comprehensive agreement. And we need to think about it holistically in order to do that. And we've got to remind people of the things that nobody else can do but the federal government, like the investments that we make in basic science and research in this country that have been so important to our leadership over the last century and will be critically important, I would argue more important, in the 21st century as we compete against a world that has shrunk as quickly as this one has. And they're giving me the hook in the back, but one just for the good of the order, I got to say, as a former school superintendent, again, the fact that only 9 out of 100 kids living in poverty in this country can expect to graduate with a college degree is hugely problematic for the United States. And we've got to fix that as well. And so the idea that we'd be making those cuts now instead of figuring out how to sort through a broader picture just defies reason.
Senator Bennett, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for tying these innovation issues to the broader reform context and your leadership.